It's the Bungie Line. My name's Ted Hager.
And I'm Alex Barnett.
And Alex, have you seen the movie The War of the Worlds?
Well, the Tom Cruise, big blockbuster.
Yeah, yeah. Another one of those Steven Spielberg works out his father issues.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you know that the tripods, the Martian tripods, when they came up and they blew that, like, sound, that big, long, like, war cry kind of sound that they did, that was actually a modified, like, digitally modified didgeridoo sound.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And they were, that was just quite a scary sound, wasn't it?
Yeah, which reminds me of something else. How do you get some of these web providers out there, some of these people with different websites, great content and stuff, how do you get them to actually make APIs? We talked to John Musser, and we've talked to other people on the show where they've talked about, you know, Jeff Barr, for instance. He's talked about how he'd gone to this web APIs and conference and stuff where it was like the business of providing web APIs. Mm-hmm. And yet there's still a lot of companies that don't do that.
It all kind of depends, right? I mean, in the early days of the web, an XML file providing content as a feed was an API, right? And then bidirectional APIs, programmable APIs, it's become very sophisticated since those kind of mid-90s days.
Yeah. But there's a lot of sites that are still just straight HTML sites, or maybe they have XML, but
a lot of the value they've got to provide is simply content.
Right. But they're not REST-based. They're not easy to get at a lot of times. And that's what our guest is today. Our guest today is John Eisen from Dapr.net. And what they do is they actually provide an interface free of charge that anybody can use to actually make REST APIs out of any site with multiple redundant content on it. So like search results and those kind of things. You can actually get back information through Dapr.net in what they call dApps.
And automate that process for you as a website provider.
So that's what we need to check out right now. Let's welcome onto the show John Eisen from Dapr.net. Let's hit the interview. On the phone with us, we have John Eisen from Dapr.net. John, how you doing?
Doing well. How you guys doing?
Doing pretty well ourselves. We want to find out a few things about Dapr, but in order to do so, maybe you could give us a little bit of an idea of who you are and how Dapr came into existence, since we understand that you and Dapr have you're pretty much a founder there, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. So I'll give you a little bit of background. I am, you know, a web hacker by history. I've spent half my life hacking on the web, which makes me pretty young. When I was 13, I started my first web company, doing web design for local companies, hotels, skateboarding companies, record labels, and so on. Mostly as a means of getting free gear. But I've long been passionate about the web, and so as I, you know, continued to grow up and went into college, I ended up becoming an intern for Alexa Internet. I grew up in Western Massachusetts and would spend my summers out in San Francisco right at the end of the dot-com boom. And
joyous time, as I recall it. I was living there as well.
I'm glad that I got to see it, you know. It was definitely an experience, and San Francisco has changed a lot since then, so it's nice to have been a part of, you know, that part of history. But during that time, I got to know Brewster Kahle, who was the founder of Alexa and also the founder of the Internet Archive, very well. And as I was finishing up school, he sort of recruited me to go over and work on the Internet Archive. And for those of you who aren't familiar, the Archive got its name by building a web archive of pretty much every page on the Internet.
So this is the Wayback Machine, right?
The Wayback Machine.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when I started at the Archive's website was a search box where you'd just type in the URL and you'd get pages from the Wayback Machine, and they had one static page of about 1,200 movies donated by a guy called Rick Preylinger. And that was it. And the goal was to sort of make it the Amazon of the nonprofit digital library world. So they wanted a dynamic website where users could contribute and upload and comment on each other's contributions, where users could specify licenses and so on for all their work. So we set out to build this at the time, and since then it's grown to have over 40,000 live concerts and hundreds of thousands of digitized books, other forms of audio, lots and lots of movies, and made it into a real digital archive that's constantly growing. And so
my first website, awful website, a horrible train wreck of a website, was on there for the longest time. I haven't checked in a long time, but it warmed my heart to know that I had like some like corner of the world where I'd be remembered somehow.
I used it regularly to be able to refer to previous versions of the Microsoft.com website. where there was this whole personalized, oh yeah, we've got to do personalization and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, I went back to 1996 Microsoft.com and said, guys, we've been through this already. Have a look. It's like, we've done this. We're revisiting the whole thing. And it's kind of interesting. Go on. You were saying that.
Yeah, well, so, you know, I mean, based upon both of your personal experiences, the Wayback Machine and the archive in general is meaningful to a lot of people. And it was a real sort of honor to be able to work on that project and to get my feet wet with real web engineering on a massive scale with millions of users and millions and millions of page views and so on. And also to sort of feel good in the morning waking up and knowing that I was working on a project that had some sort of positive contribution to the world, or maybe if not the world, then, you know, at least the internet world.
Did you work with J.D. Lasseker at all as part of that project?
Yeah, a little bit when we sort of got them going with the R Media project.
Mm.
Yeah, we sort of provided at the time the storage and bandwidth for that project, which was also pretty interesting.
So that's a whole conversation in and of itself that I hadn't even anticipated in having you come on the show here. But we should move forward. We should jump into, tell us about how you came to Dapper and what you guys are doing with Dapper.
Well, so when I was working at the archive, I met a cool guy by the name of Eran Shir, an Israeli guy, and I also have Israeli roots, and that's sort of how we connected. And we sort of stayed in touch over the next couple of years, and when I found myself in Israel after having chased a girl out there, I was sort of looking for stuff to do, and Eran had this really cool idea that he'd been thinking about for years, which was to make it incredibly easy to, you know, make data on the internet portable, to be able to take portions of websites reliably and reuse them in, you know, what is now called mashups, and, you know, sort of make it more portable, make content extraction from the web really easy, maybe even go so far as programming for the masses, you know, letting normal people remix and reuse information from the web. And this sounded something that was right up my alley. You know, at the archive, I'd spent a lot of time, and at Alexa, a lot of time working on web services and become passionate about, you know, these sort of back-end services that really power so many applications. And so we thought, wow, it would be really amazing if every website on the internet had web services. And, you know, this is the semantic web's dream, right? You know, Tim Berners-Lee set out 10 years ago and said, oh, man, like, every site should have structured access to its data, and then all the doors are open. Well, it turns out, you know, 10 years later, it didn't really work out so well because content owners don't really have an incentive to go off and build web services. It's, you know, the new way of thinking, there are many incentives, but that doesn't solve the fact that 99% of the web still doesn't cater to those incentives. And so we said, you know, we should put the power in the hands of the people who actually have the need to get content from a website. If we give them the tools, they already have the incentive. And so we set out to build Dapper, which is basically a web-based point-and-click interface for building web services for any website.
So when you say point-and-click, build web services out of any website, okay, so give us a scenario website maybe where somebody might want to make an API, it doesn't already have an API, and let us know what kind of APIs they can get out of it too.
Okay, so here's the deal. Your creativity is the limit in the sense that anything that a remote website provides through its front end, Dapper can create an API for. That includes search and interactivity. That includes, you know, dynamic data that changes regularly. And that also includes login and so on. So, you know, just for the sake of an example, take a recipe website, even a big recipe website. They don't provide an API that I know of for recipe search. I want to search for recipes that have, you know, chicken in them because I want to, you know, make dinner tonight. And maybe I want to build some application around this that allows me to search for all recipes and bring back, you know, nutritional information from some other website and so on. And I'd be pretty hard-pressed, even as a, you know, sophisticated developer, to do this. I'd spend a lot of time writing fragile regular expressions to extract information from allrecipes.com and not really have the means to do it and work on my actual application. So you just go and point and click. You do a search, a couple searches at all recipes using Dapper, just to give us a couple examples, and you say, okay, this is the kind of page I want to work with, and then you point and click, you say, this thing here, this is the name of a recipe, this thing here is the summary of the recipe, and this thing is the person who submitted it, and so on, and all of these things together form a recipe, and on this page, there's, you know, search results, there's 10 recipes or 20 recipes or whatever, and then Dapper can work on any search. You tell it this API, this web service, this DAP, has an input, search terms, or ingredient, or whatever it may be. And there you go. You've got an XML API for that website, all by pointing and clicking.
So XML is one of your APIs out there. There are certain XML formats you support as well. I think you guys do Atom and you do RSS, right?
Yeah, so actually the way it works is we always output our core XML format. And then we have these things called transformers, which are open source, community-contributed plugins, basically, that take the XML that we produce and transform it using a set of rules into another format. So in RSS, for instance, we say, hey, you know, RSS requires that you have a title, a body, and a date, right? Now, some of those things are optional, but you would say for the recipe site, use the recipe name as the title, use the recipe summary as the body, and use the submitted time as the date. So each one of those transformers has its own rules, and we do support RSS and Atom and CSV, support JSON, support image loops, so if the site has images, we support Flash Widget. You can even create, without any programming, a Facebook application for any website using Dapper.
What's the story around bidirectional communication on the APIs?
So you mean in terms of being able to submit content into the website?
Right, or changes.
Right, so again, basically any functionality that we can reproduce through the website. So if they, like, you know, if you have a... I'll take Swivel, where you can upload a CSV file for graphing. You can use Dapper to create a Swivel API, and you can, just like you would post to Swivel, you would post to Dapper, and Dapper will submit it to Swivel.
And pretty much that becomes a URL-based posting to it, usually, right, through Dapper?
Yeah, we have a REST web service. It works over GET and over POST.
So the whole thing ends up being RESTful.
Yep.
So a couple things that come to mind on that, then. You mentioned passwords, and... I'm curious to know, okay, so you guys are doing a hosted service. These APIs actually are hosted by Dapper, and you guys are going to these websites, correct?
Absolutely.
So somewhere in there, there's the question of, what about the escrow of my password? Does that actually get stored on your site, or am I supplying that through the URL I provide and you just relay it over? And what's my assurance level for my password being stored securely?
Okay, so there is, you know, obviously a reasonable amount of trust. If you don't trust Dapper to handle your password in any capacity, then, you know, the system doesn't work. So you do need to trust Dapper to some extent. The guarantee we make is that we never store the password anywhere. What happens is we have another web service which takes your unencrypted username and password, which you submit to us via HTTPS in a post, and then we give you back an encrypted value. From then on, you can just pass your encrypted username and password in URL. And the main reason for that is because people get freaked out about seeing their username and password in the clear. It would end up in our logs and so on, and therefore we like to have it encrypted. But again, there's an issue of trust. And we take that password and we relay it on using the highest security that the remote website supports, which is typically POST and HTTPS. And we do the and we proxy your password for you. And we make you the promise that we don't store it, and then it just becomes an issue of trusting us not to store it.
And how does your system handle schema changes over on the source site?
So that's actually a really good question, and that gets a little bit at the core of Dapper's technology. Dapper, unlike many conventional, you know, quote-unquote screen scraping technologies, doesn't use regular expressions, and doesn't use XPath, and doesn't use other relatively fragile means of extracting content from a page. Rather, we've built our algorithms on graph theory, meaning we understand structures inside the DOM, and as a result, what ends up happening is that we're pretty robust to changes. So assume that, you know, you have a site where today when you built your dApp, there were no ads, and tomorrow they insert 3 ads down the side. The dApp will continue working because the localized structures of the content haven't changed dramatically. And we have some allowance for them to change, you know, even substantially, but... let's talk about reality. People change websites dramatically. Mm. You know, on the whole, if you look at the web, there's probably major websites changing majorly all the time, right? And so we definitely experience it, and currently what we do is we notice. We pay close attention. We have systems that monitor all of the output of our APIs, and if we see them starting to deteriorate, we notify the creator that something seems to be going wrong.
So somebody can go back in and... sort of police their API, see what things are being affected, try to do remapping if they can to preserve the integrity of the API, but they can also recreate and re-implement if they need.
Yeah, it's very simple. We send out an email that says, click here to edit your API, and you go in and it allows you to modify the existing API according to the names of the fields that you had before. So what we're planning to do going forward is implement some degree of automatic fixing. So we can notice where the content is on the page, and we can notice other similar structures within the page and automatically correct the DAP for you. And that's not out yet, but that's for down the line.
But so if somebody rolls out new CSS that restructures the look of their site, the data structures are generally the same underneath. You guys aren't affected by that, right?
Yeah, in fact, CSS is the best kind of change because it doesn't impact the structure of the page itself. It doesn't impact the HTML. We do use some heuristics in certain cases that rely on, you know, class names and stuff, but they're just one of many heuristics that we use. So when, let's say, somebody changes the name of a class, we fall back on other heuristics that allow us to continue matching appropriately. So, yeah, CSS is actually one of the best parts because it allows you to change the form of the page without changing its formatting or its structure.
Okay, so one of the things that I thought was the most sexy thing about this, when I first saw your demo, Aran showed me this, and he showed me it at the, I guess it was Mashup Camp in Silicon Valley, just this last one that just happened this fall or late summer. When he showed it to me, the concept, as you explained, it sounds like it'd be something difficult to use, but you guys have made a really cool WYSIWYG interface. This is just all like JSPs that represent the website as it would look to me in a browser. This is going on in the browser, and I just sort of highlight all the fields on it and things like that. Are there limitations to that, though? Because, I mean, that's pretty slick. There's this point and click, point and shoot, and that works pretty well, it seems. But what kind of speed bumps and things like that do you find? What kind of things should people watch out for?
Well, you know, we take serious pride in the fact that we've made this a web-based solution, and there's no downloading involved, and the whole concept there is to get people to be able to use this very quickly. But, you know, people who develop for the web, and especially people who develop sophisticated and rich Internet applications on the web, understand that, you know, to take desktop functionality and put it into the web is non-trivial. One of the things that I think is the coolest thing we've done so far is if you click on data inside a table in a page, we actually allow you to bring up an Excel interface with complete with, like, the headers and on both the rows and the columns, and you can do multiple selections and deselections and so on, just as if you were in Excel. But what kind of roadblocks do we hit? We hit all sorts of, you know, issues regarding, well, there's the issues of cross-domain AJAX that you have to deal with. There's the issue of the fact that people just write really, really horrible websites that do crazy things. I got to say that supporting logins on other people's websites has been some of the hardest stuff we've dealt with. Logging into MySpace involves something like 7 redirects through bizarre pages with non-standard HTTP headers. And so these are some serious roadblocks that you hit, and you know, it's part of what makes it take so long to cover the whole web, because you think you got a solution that's great, and then you realize, hey, there's this website, and that opens up another can of worms. And you've got to sort of solve things on a case-by-case basis.
We've dealt with that, actually, in our own platform, Bungie Connect. We actually have dealt with that a little bit with Facebook, because Facebook actually has this weird, they want to do a post back to your application. And yeah, I understand what you're saying. Those kind of things could be a challenge there, huh?
Can I ask then, John, how do you think the industry can or should solve the issue around having multiple homegrown authentication authorization systems?
Well, you know, I mean, there's a lot of support these days in our community for things like OpenID, and they certainly sound like great solutions to the problem. You know, I'm kind of a practicalist, and it might make me unpopular to say it, but I think part of the web's, you know, success has been the fact, and it's made a huge mess for us, but it's also contributed to success, the fact that people can and do go off and build things however they want. The fact that browsers don't require HTML to be correct has got to be one of the hardest things we've had to deal with at Dapper, but is probably one of the biggest causes for the fact that we have so many websites out there today. And the fact that there's a very low bar for implementing web applications, you know, be it being good or bad, I think is actually a good thing because it causes lots of development and activity. As far as solving the fact that there's many different authentication schemes out there, the solution is typically through standards, and you know, OpenID is a good standard, and if you can get a lot of people to adopt it, then it's fantastic. But I think that we'll always see problems getting people to adopt things, just like, you know, we haven't seen people adopt the technologies required to make the semantic web.
Yes.
is that all you have? That's all you've got, Alex? So there's probably some videos out there, and I'm hoping you'll provide us a link so we can link to it from the show notes so that people can get an idea of how to use this. It's just pretty much right on your website. You have this demo stuff, correct?
Absolutely.
So we'll definitely link to that. But a question I think that comes up is, as I hear this, and I've explained your site to a couple other people and what you guys do as a service, I've had people ask me, so how do they monetize that? What is their business model for doing APIs?
That's always like a golden question, you know. It's something that, as a founder of a startup, you have to know how to answer well, and, you know.
The golden question is, where does the gold come from?
Exactly, yes. Exactly. So I'll tell you, first of all, that we've spent all of our efforts so far until today on core technology. We believe really strongly that any business we build around Dapper has to be built on a strong technical foundation. Because if Dapper doesn't work well, then whatever business we build around it won't work well either. So really, you know, 100% of our efforts to date have been on core technology and not on business. That's changing now, much to, I'm sure, the pleasure of our investors. And also to us as founders, we want to see Dapper become a big business. And so we have a variety of models. The one that we're pursuing most heavily today is what we call Dapper Ads. And, you know, before you cringe at the clicheness of making money off of advertising, I'll tell you that no, we're not embedding AdSense ads into our website or even into our feeds, but we're trying to do something really creative. So first of all, it should be noted that we don't really believe in charging for the core service. I don't really think developers or consumers are going to go off and pay for the ability to create an RSS feed for a site that doesn't have one or make a Facebook application casually. And, you know, our users are a big part of our success, and we don't want to have to charge them for using the service. So then wherein comes the money, and what is Dapper Ads? So the concept that we're basically working on is, as a user goes and creates a website, he effectively is defining semantics for that website, right? Now, let's take the recipe website example, okay? Take a recipe. You can effectively create an API that extracts the content of any recipe on that site. And some of the fields in your API, some of the XML elements might be ingredient, preparation time, number of calories, grams of fat, recipe title, name of submitter, and so on. Now, understand what you can do with that kind of information in the realm of advertising that you couldn't do with a conventional ad network like AdSense. Now, AdSense, I have to admit, is very, very good at extracting meaningful keywords, but the algorithm's a little blind. It doesn't know that the number 200 is the number of calories. It doesn't know that 6 eggs is the number of ingredients. So let's take two really cool recipe-related examples. One is with the ingredients. Now, let's say we have an advertiser like NetGrocer that sells ingredients. Okay, we can effectively, on the fly, create a mini mashup, which is an ad, that takes the ingredients out of the recipe, shows them in an ad with the price for each ingredient, like the cart total, and says, click here to purchase this cart. And that's something that a conventional ad network can't actually do. And so what we've actually done, we have at dapperads.com, we have a pilot program that we're encouraging people to take part in, which works with Amazon. So let's say you have a music review website where you have many pages, each one is a review of a new album. We allow you to create an API, create a dApp for your website, where you indicate where the name of the album is. So you click the name of the album and say, album name. And then you tell in our interface, connect to Amazon, connect to their music section, take the album name from my page and stick it into album title at Amazon, and then we give you JavaScript, you embed it on every one of your album review pages, that on the fly extracts the name of the album from the page, searches for it at Amazon, and shows you the lowest price they currently have. Dynamic ad using semantic information from your website. That's the model we're working.
So does this also become sort of some kind of adjunct to your API as well, or the APIs that you create, so that somebody could actually have this as like almost a tandem thing where they can tap into that kind of thing?
Yeah, and today we don't embed ads into the API results or anything like that, but the concept is that, you know, publishers often come into Dapper and create, you know, quote-unquote APIs for their site. They create an RSS feed, they create a Google gadget, and many of them are obviously looking for ways to generate revenue. And so they can definitely use Dapper to generate revenue. Now, of course, this doesn't apply to every kind of website. You know, a blog, for instance, has limited semantics. It's got post title, post body, post date. These are things that semantically for advertising don't bring a lot of value. But there are lots and lots of websites on the internet that do have a template and do have rich semantics, from recipe sites to electronic sites to review sites to e-commerce sites and so on. And those are the kinds of sites that we hope to sort of get to participate in this. So, those are the kinds of ads. Our eventual vision is really to provide like a mashup maker that lets you build ads, both as an advertiser and also as a publisher. And the real theory and what we're testing today is to see if the CTR on these ads is higher, the click-through rate on these ads is higher than conventional ads because they're really very targeted, much more so than what a conventional ad network could do. So it's kind of interesting to see how we're taking the semantic web and applying it to advertising. My personal goal and what I'd love to see as a contribution to the web, ads today are pretty annoying to users. Even the most relevant ones are pretty annoying. But I'd like to sort of blend the line between content and advertising, right? If you can deliver content to a user that's meaningful and relevant to what he's looking at, then it's a valuable service to the user. And the advertiser gets, you know, some benefit out of it, the user gets some benefit out of it, and therefore people are willing to pay and everybody makes money and everyone goes home happy.
So increased relevance is what you're getting at, right?
Yeah, increased relevance through the use of
semantics
on both the publisher side and the advertiser side.
And do you think the industry's ready for that approach?
I certainly hope so. But yeah, I think so. I think what we're learning very quickly is anything that improves click-through rates, anything that gets users more interested in what advertisers are trying to get them interested in, is very compelling. The real test will be, you know, how well, how fast, how accurately we're able to deliver these ads. And that's what we're working on now. We're just starting out, and so that's why we're constantly looking for people to participate and embed these ads on their website. In the pilot project with Amazon, we're allowing the publishers to keep 100% of the commission that Amazon gives on any of the products sold. So for us, we're just sort of in a data gathering point.
Right. Give us an understanding. How many sites today have feeds coming off the Dabble.net site?
There's about 25,000 dApps today.
Mm-hmm.
These are mostly community created, right? The people that use the site, the developers that need these APIs are creating these 25,000?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was a time when you could say that a significant portion of the dApps very early on were created by me and Aran. But, you know, we maybe between the two of us have created 300 dApps at this point, so it's a very small percentage now. And yeah, absolutely, and they're shared. There's a lot of dApps that are very, very popular. One person creates a dApp, an API for some site, and then other people find it and use it. And maybe that one person creates a dApp, like I created the YouTube search results dApp, but now it's a very popular dApp, and it's not because I built something that uses it. It's because other people built something that uses it.
Have there been concerns from some of the sites that you provide feeds for?
We're losing control.
And how have you handled those?
Well, yeah, okay. So clearly, as you can imagine, before there was even any concern from publishers, there was concern from investors and from potential partners, and everybody wanted to know, well, what about legitimacy? You know, you're giving people an incredibly powerful tool, but who says they can use it? It might not be legitimate to use it. And that's also a really big part of our vision. We don't believe in piracy. We don't believe in allowing people to just steal other people's content. That's not in the spirit of the Internet, and it's not sustainable, not for us as a business and not for the people who use us. And it should be noted, of course, that there's a difference between personal use and commercial use, but not every publisher sees that difference. So we've set out to address this issue in a number of ways. And yes, there has been concern, and we've addressed it in a number of ways. I can't say that anybody has been unhappy with the resolution, so that's good news. What we've done is we've built the foundations of a platform, okay, which allows content publishers to specify how and if their content can be used. Okay, so today there's four options. We partnered with Creative Commons to provide these options in a legally significant way.
So, nice move.
Yeah, so we really like the Creative Commons guys. They're really awesome. And we feel that, you know, they're really sort of advancing the state of content collaboration and sharing and making it possible to let people use your content without losing all control over it. And that's really what we believe. We believe that it's important to give publishers control so that they can let people use their content, but in the ways that they see fit. So today, what we do is we have a bunch of licenses, quote-unquote licenses. You come, you prove you own your site, and then the Dapper engine will respect that. What that means is you can say, I want, it's okay for people to use my content, but they have to link back to me. This is akin to the attribution license of Creative Commons. You can specify whether for commercial purposes or not. We've got the public domain license. We've got one that is the default license, which is my direct permission is required. Okay, and then we've got a fourth one which says, no, you can't use it, sorry. And if a publisher selects that, any dApp that's been created immediately stops working. And it really stinks for the developer who went and built some awesome mashup, but it's important to respect the rights of the content owners. I mean, it is their content, and they put a lot of money, a lot of time and effort into producing it.
Totally, yeah.
What's interesting to note about those who select no, typically we contact them, and we say, hey, you know, we respect your right to do that, but let's talk about it. And usually they end up going back and saying, it's cool as long as you link to me. And that's because it's very easy to make a compelling argument that says, hey, look, you know, let people use your content. It'll pay off. It's not just karma. People will link to you. You'll get more traffic to your site. These are probably people that are not coming to your site anyway if they're looking at your content somewhere else. It's time to sort of let go a little bit, and people realize that. And so we've got big companies like Answers.com and several MTV television shows who've set their licenses accordingly, Jambase.com, and then hundreds and hundreds of smaller guys who are all about getting people to use their content. And so the way we've addressed it and made people happy is by giving them the opt-out. What we really do envision, although I don't see it being immediate for this platform, is to even let there be a finer degree of control. There's a lot of things Dapper can enforce since we proxy the content. For instance, we could let a content publisher say, hey, you know, you can use my content, but only between 2 and 5 in the morning when my servers aren't busy, or only up to 100 hits a day, or only content that's not on my homepage, or only content that comes through my RSS feeds already, and so on and so forth. We have a fifth license today to sort of capture some of those things, which are according to the following terms. And then the content provider can simply write in what he wants. Naturally, we can't enforce those things, but down the line, we'd like to. And finally, and speaking of business models, you know, I'm not sure this will ever be our primary model, but perhaps we also intend to allow content providers to say, yeah, you can use my content for $100 a month or $3 for 100 hits or so on and so forth.
Well, that gets to a question, though, that I was kind of thinking on your business model. And as well, I know that there are companies that right now are looking at web APIs and saying, man, we need to do this, but it's going to take a bunch of effort from us. And it's just really making our content accessible. You guys have the ability to do that. Are there any companies coming to you at this point and saying, we want you guys to become our maintainers, if you will, of our API? We want you guys to be our API provider.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Companies approach us a lot. First of all, a lot of them don't even talk to us. They just go off and do it, you know. And that tends to be smaller companies that don't have, you know, branding issues. So, you know, there's like one of the biggest movie sites in Brazil uses us to supply RSS feeds. We have a feature on our site called Distribute Your Content. You go, you build a dApp, and then you just press next, and you choose the output formats you want, RSS, Atom, whatever. And then we create a HTML code with those chiclets in it, and people put that on their website all over the net. Now, as far as bigger companies, yeah, we have, you know, straight-up partnerships with companies like Answers.com. We power their Facebook applications. They said, you know what, we aren't going to undergo the cost and expense and effort of developing a Facebook app, at least not today. We'd like to get started, though, and, you know, so we worked with them, and we have this thing called the Facebook Application Maker. And somebody in their marketing department built the application, which is really cool. They didn't even need a developer to go off and do it.
Nice. And on the consuming side, are there commercial sites that are relying on your APIs?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So what about the SLA front? I mean, how do they...
Service level agreements.
Yeah. How do they kind of manage that piece, given that there are a number of points of breakage, sometimes nothing to do with you, right? The originating site has broken the schema, and downstream something critical maybe on their side is not working. How do you solve that?
Well, I'll tell you, the SLAs were born out of something very amusing. You know, we were approached by companies left and right that said, "You guys have an awesome service. When will you start charging for it?" And we said, "I don't know," and they'd be like, "Well, you know, let us know when you start charging for it, and then we'll start using it." Said, "Fine, we'll start charging for it. No problem. You want to pay? That's great." But honestly, the reason they wanted it was for some reasonable assurance that we will care about them. And SLAs also, you know, get people their own server so they don't have to share the bandwidth and the CPU with our regular users and so on.
So you do this already then?
Yeah, we have this already dealt with. And I have to tell you that, you know, most people are satisfied with the free service. Most companies say, you know, this works really well, because the truth is that we really care about even our most casual users. To us, it's very embarrassing when we break, because it means so many other people are breaking. So we do everything we can to not break. It's incredibly important to us, be you IBM or Microsoft or some small-time guy who built an RSS feed, who that's all he uses it for. And that's all very important to us, because if it breaks for one person, it breaks for everybody, and that's just no good for anybody.
Now, you mentioned about the future of your business, and you're just starting off this pilot with your, I like the phrase, semantic ad network. Taking a step back, maybe just outside of the immediate context of Dapper.net, what do you notice as the kind of big mega trends happening in the world of web development and businesses that are based on web technologies?
And what are you going to do about it too?
Okay, that's an interesting question.
Really?
I think that the big trend, at least the one that's most relevant to us that we see online today, is really this sort of semantification of the web. Some people call it Web 3.0 or whatever you want to call it, but we're a big part of it, and you see it left and right. You see Google Mashup Editor, you see Popfly, you see Yahoo Pipe. So those are the big guys' efforts. There's also Intel Mashmaker. Then you see awesome companies like Adaptive Blue and their SmartLinks product. You see guys like Swivel. We're all sort of playing in the next sort of big step of the web, which is using semantics inside the web to improve or alter the way we interact with the web. So, you know, Adaptive Blue is like a really good example. You're browsing some blog, and it notices that there's a music product on that blog. And so they provide you with these really cool contextual links that says, hey, go to Amazon and check this page out, or look at other albums by this artist at, you know, Last FM or whatever. And these are sort of big changes that have a very small footprint. I mean, I don't know that people understand the bigger implications and the underlying things that are changing here. But these are really big things. In 3 years, you know, we will have taken them for granted, and the web will have really changed, and the way we use it will have really changed. I'm not sure if this answers your question, though.
Well, I think it does. I mean, to say that what you're saying is that Tim Berners-Lee's vision is becoming somewhat more real. It's the semantic web with maybe lower caps, right?
Exactly.
We're seeing new and interesting companies emerging, taking advantage of that. Now, in order for that to really happen and to really take off, we need essentially more structured data as almost de facto way of publishing content, at least, for web publishers, right? In order for then the services to be able to have increased value because they're able to tap into more content, and these kind of network effects kick off. But the work that we've seen around initiatives like microformats, for example, has been a step towards that direction. And I agree with you that I think that we've seen these small, little incremental steps towards a more semantic web. It'll be very interesting to see how an ad network essentially can tap into the power of that. Now, obviously, you're going to be leveraging the network that you've built out across 25,000 sites. Presumably, I mean, some of them are going to be very large sites, like high traffic with a lot of content. How do you see the ability to be able to tap beyond outside your own immediate network in terms of the other structured data that might be flowing out on the web but not necessarily tied into your system, if you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I get it. So first of all, what we're working on inside the system, and we already have support, you can create a dApp out of an existing RSS feed. Soon you'll be able to create a dApp out of an existing API or any structured data. And so Dapper can become a focal point for those wanting a unified or a single interface to all, you know, data, structured or unstructured, on the Internet. As far as, you know, making something that's globally accessible, obviously it would be awesome if everybody used Dapper and went through Dapper to build their stuff. But at the same time, you know, there's not necessarily a need for that. We see a lot of developers use Dapper in conjunction with Flickr's API, in conjunction with, you know, Delicious's API, and so on. And I think that we see lots and lots of companies offering APIs and other structured ways of getting at their data, low cost, lightweight services. And I think that's all very good for the web.
Excellent. Well, I think we have one last question to ask you on our list of questions here. This one might go a little bit in a more technical direction, but how did the thing with the girl in Israel work out?
It worked out pretty well. I've since relocated back to the States. The whole team is in Tel Aviv, and I'm out in San Francisco about 3 weeks a month, and I managed to drag her back with me. She seems to be enjoying it. So today is actually our 4-year anniversary.
I love a story with a happy ending.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
John, thanks very much for joining us on the Bungie Line.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks.
So pretty cool stuff that Dapper's doing, huh?
Yeah, very good.
You know what was another thing, though, that I thought was really cool of them is while I was doing the setup for getting this interview going and everything, I actually mentioned to John in an email, I said to him, hey, I've got a problem. I'm trying to get a dApp created out of Last.fm, and it keeps hanging up at a certain point. And so he actually just pinged an engineer. The engineer actually looked at what I was trying to do, got a fix into Dapper's system, and it got right past that. So these guys are also very responsive. I don't think it was just because it was you and me from the Bungie Line doing this. I think that kind of responsiveness would probably exist for a lot of people. It's very nice when you have these startup companies, you know, that are just eager to make their services work well.
Sweet.
Now, web tips. What we didn't do one last episode, so we try to usually do something every show.
Yeah,
you got anything?
I think web tips or bits of news,
yeah,
or tidbits. Right?
Interesting things.
And there was something that kind of was very big news that came out yesterday. By the time you hear this, it may have been last week.
It might be 2 weeks ago.
It could have been, yeah.
We're here to bring you old news.
Fast. Google, a lot of speculation over the last few months around whether they're going to bring out their G phone.
Yeah.
And the news was kind of even bigger than that, that they announced yesterday.
And the news was?
The news was that, in fact, they're providing a mobile operating system called Android. And it's actually based on an acquisition that they made in 2005. And they've announced the Open Handset Alliance. It's a Linux-based operating system. And they reckon they're going to be out with partners and mobile devices and all the rest of it by about mid-2008. Now, what's interesting, and the reason I'm bringing it up, is that there's some discussion now as to the choice they've made around the licensing around the kernel, right? So the kernel is GPL2, the Linux kernel.
Yeah, and Linus Torvalds is sticking to that GPL2, but then there's all the infrastructure above that.
That's right, and they've decided to choose Apache, the ASL license for that. I wanted to get your take. Why do you think they might be going down that route rather than the GPL on the kernel, as it is for the kernel?
Well, seeing as though I don't know anything about the Apache license.
It's like FreeBSD. It's very similar, but it's not.
So the thing about some of the licenses, the GPL has in it what could be described loosely as compulsory altruism written into it. Any kind of things that you do with the code, you have to turn back when you release the product that you make from that code. So you have to actually reciprocate your contributions into the code. You have to make it as a contribution.
Right.
So there's a loophole for service providers like Google normally when you offer an online service, however you mod the kernel and things. If you're not redistributing the software but just building a service with it, you can actually not turn your stuff back over. But as soon as you put it on a device or something, then the reciprocal altruism out there, you have to actually put it out, out the code modifications that you've done. So I don't know enough about the Apache license and whether it has that written tightly into it, but you said it's similar to BSD.
I believe it's more closely aligned to something like BSD, which doesn't require you to be able to throw back the code of any modifications that you've made.
Yeah, and that gets into a huge debate between people. You know, there's some people that say that GPL is more free because it requires people to free their intellectual, you know, contributions into it or make them as contributions, turn them into contributions. There are also the camp that says, you know, as soon as you make altruism compulsory, there's really not freedom there. And so the BSD people often, I've heard a few of them say, you know, hey, the thing about our license is it is more free because we don't require you to contribute back. We strongly encourage. Companies like Apple are motivated to do so because, you know, they want to see that stuff integrated and maintained and become part of the BSD kernel. Now, I don't know about Apache, but if it's similar in that regard, it may allow them to put some things with that software and distribute. The question then becomes, is having GPL code coupled to that in a distribution, does that make it a distribution, in which case the Apache licenses get overridden by the GPL? I don't know. I think it's going to be fun to watch people debate about that one. So this came out of a company called, what was it, Android?
They acquired Android in 2005.
And it's only now that this is actually bearing fruit, or that it's becoming something for them.
Yeah, 2 years later.
It's an interesting thing. I've got a friend, actually, who used to be at Zimian, the makers of the GNOME desktop, or one of the companies that was very deeply involved in that. His name's Robert Love. He was actually brought into Novell after he had worked with the Zimian guys for quite a while, not actually at Zimian. He went to Google. And he's one of the guys who's a fairly famous kernel hacker, a good friend of mine, just recently blogged about this as well on his blog post. You know, it was just a very short thing. He hasn't said whether he's involved in this or not. And I've tried to pump him for information, say, you know, tell me, what are you working on at Google? What is your top secret project? I'm going to guess that he might be involved in this in some way, because it would seem like having a good kernel hacker able to enable the Android operating system, you know, this version of Linux, to really work well on the mobile device, that's going to take somebody really sharp.
Yeah, and it's going to be exciting to see what comes out of this, because you've got obviously Google motivated as another advertising vehicle or entire market they can essentially create revenue out of. They've got their Google apps. It's going to be interesting to see what the widget space might look like around that. The whole kind of Google gears, local, offline, occasionally connected computing. Google lots to offer in this area.
The one that intrigues me most, though, is this is a great battleground area, the mobile device, great battleground area for the bearing out of whether open source can really compete well. Mm. And it's got some advantages over things like the mobile versions of Windows that are there, in that the whole thing is open and you can get anywhere in the source code and make modifications wherever you need. It's not just you have APIs, it's you have the entire stack of software in there. So this could become very interesting to see what are manufacturers of mobile devices going to do with this.
But haven't we gone down this route before and failed? I mean, isn't that what Symbian was about?
Or Palm Source, or those kinds of things.
I mean, those are huge projects. They argue that open source will win over the proprietary. And we've seen Windows Mobile take up a huge amount of market share. What do you think's different this time?
I think there are two differences. The first difference is that you're no longer talking about a niche thing going to open source. You're talking about the primary operating system of open source, which is, of course, Linux. So this is a Linux-based thing. You've got more hackers that know that kernel than just about any other thing out there. So unlike having to learn whatever the kernel is for a particular mobile device, this is the centerline thing, so people can transfer skills right into it. The second thing is that you've got an alliance being built around this with a huge center post company like Google. And having them and the weight of that company behind it, the market force that they can drive, I think really changes the game from, you know, somebody like Palm OS having tried this in the past or anything.
Coming from an old industry, trying to make it into the new, and arguably now with Google at the center of the internet, really mobile phones are becoming another internet device. And this is what they've got to bring to the party in that respect.
Absolutely. So I think those two things, though, that's the power of this one. But I don't think it's a fait accompli in any way. It's not just already done.
Well, they haven't even got a product now, though,
right?
Mid-2008.
We have to see this actually come out on devices, and we have to see these devices get picked up and used.
Good stuff. Well, I think that'll be one to track and see what that means in terms of web development in the future.
Absolutely. It'll be intriguing. So thanks, everyone, for listening. And once again, we want to encourage you, drop us some emails if you're interested in the show and liking what kind of things we're talking about, or want to correct me on things like saying, say, the Palm OS was an attempt at bringing one of these to market, because it really doesn't map that well. Anyway, drop us an email. It's alexb@bungielabs.com and ted@bungielabs.com. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.